we turn the page and consider Yahweh's testimony, we were considering Yeshayah, which is Isaiah, the 51st chapter, which speaks of Yahweh's return. There's a number of interesting insights, particularly about his statements regarding his return. The first of those is he speaks of his return under his name, as Yahweh, not under Yahusha, and most certainly not under Jesus Christ. There is no Jesus Christ, and there will be no return of Jesus Christ. Yahusha was more of a mission statement than it was a name. The name Yahusha means, and mission statement conveys, Yahweh saves. It is Yahweh who is our Savior. It is Yahweh who will return. If you do not know Yahweh, you do not know God. Speaking of his return, this is what he has to say. Indeed, Yahweh will comfort Zion. So he is returning for what? Is he returning for his church? No, because he does not have a church. There's nothing even remotely related to a church in his testimony. Yes, I know you would read that in the lips of Jesus Christ in your English Bible, but the name Jesus Christ cannot be found in any of the oldest manuscripts, none of the 69 manuscripts that precede Constantine will you find Jesus Christ or anything resembling it, and nor will you find any Greek word that even resembles church. Church is the name of a pagan sun goddess, Circe. She was the daughter of Helios, the sun god. Yahweh is coming back for Zion. What is Zion? It's not only a mountain in Israel, and he's coming back to comfort those around that mountain in Israel, but Zion is symbolic of something much more than just Israel. It is specifically the signpost along the way. The way is the seven-step path from our world to God that begins with Passover and ends with Sukkah shelters, camping out with God. That is the way. The signpost, of course, that's his word, the Torah. He's coming back on behalf of his Torah, which is the place where you will find the way. Indeed, Yahweh will comfort Zion. He will console, demonstrating compassion. He's going to be merciful to Zion, to those who have embraced his word, which is his Torah, and who have embarked on his way, which is the Mikre, the seven steps that we walk to God, beginning with Passover and ending with Sukkah shelters. He will demonstrate compassion to all of her destroyed and depopulated places. Yes, Muslims and socialist secular humanists will run amok. And within the first year of the beginning of the tribulation, which is going to begin in the fall of 2026, I know this because God made his timeline obvious to us. All you have to understand is the creation account, his path of 6 plus 1 equals 7, and you can know that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden just 20 years shy of 6,000 years ago, and that Yahusha fulfilled the first four Moed Mikre, these invitations to meet with God, enabling the benefits of the covenant exactly 40 Yobel or 2,000 years ago. Just 20 years shy of 2,000 years ago. And it becomes obvious that the unfulfilled Moed Mikre, the sixth of the seventh, is Yom Kippurim, and that is the day that he's coming to console, to show his mercy, to reconcile his relationship with Yisrael and with Yehudim, which will take place as a result of Zion. He tells us this. He makes it obvious to us. But he is also telling us that the conditions that will be perpetrated, the horror that will be perpetrated on the world, the destroyed and depopulated places of the world will be horrific when he returns. Man, emboldened and enraged by religion and politics, by their allegiance to their militaries, will destroy. the very things we talk about that we ought not show our allegiance to in the first half of this program are going to be unleashed against humankind. And more than half of the population of this planet is going to die as a result of man's inhumanity to man. And it is to those destroyed and depopulated places that he is going to return. He says, and even her lifeless places devoid of the word, Midbar, Sim, he's going to transform them. He says they will become like Eden. And also her desert wasteland will be like the garden enclosure. Rather than saying gone Eden, the Garden of Eden, he is saying in Eden gone. He is going to return the earth, all of the hellish atrocities that man has perpetrated against his fellow man. That man becomes good at one thing in the last days, and that's killing, destroying. And God said, I'm going to undo all of the hellish results of human political, religious, and military schemes. And I'm going to return the earth to the place that we started. So we've come full circle. This is Yahweh's return. And what is he saying that he's going to do on his return? He's going to return our planet back to Eden, to the garden enclosure. He says, and so her lifeless places devoid of the word will be like Eden, and also her desert wasteland will be like the garden enclosure of Yahweh. So if you want to know where we're headed, that's the answer. If you want to know what eternity is going to be like, look at the conditions in the Garden of Eden. That is why it is so important that we spend time understanding what God had to say about life in Eden. If you like the story of Eden, if you like the God who was presented in Eden, if you like the relationship that God had with humanity in Eden, if you like what they did, what they said, the conditions experienced there, then you'll like eternity. If you don't, if you discount the Torah, if you say, nah, you know, we live under the New Testament, I don't want to pay attention to that Torah, then you'd find Eden to be hellish. But for those of us who have embraced the covenant, who know that Yahweh's Torah teaching is the means that he uses to guide us to this end result where we become his children, we know what he says is true. He says overwhelming happiness and joy will be found in her. In her what? In this Garden of Eden. This restored, reaffirmed planet that God is going to conceive out of the wreckage of human destruction. Overwhelming happiness and joy will be found in her. Songs of thanksgiving and the sound of singing and accompaniment of musical instruments. Sorrow and mourning for the dead will disappear. We will finally reach a point where man will stop killing man. This is the story of our relationship with God, and of God coming full circle and returning us to the place that we all began. This is the message behind the Mikra of Sukkah, where we invited to camp out with our Heavenly Father in the Eretz, which is now Eden. We will all sing songs. We will be happy. And also, since Zion is the heart of the land, the metaphor, which is the realm of God, it has been defined. The Eretz and Eden will become a garden enclosure suitable for the growth and for life that brings ultimate happiness. Yahweh wants us to understand that Abraham and Sarah, his human partners in the establishment of the familial covenant relationship, represent him as our merciful Father and the set-apart Spirit, the maternal aspect of Yahweh's nature that is responsible for our long-awaited spiritual rebirth. And for those who may just have joined us today and do not know that this passage was preceded by Yahweh saying, if you're interested in salvation, you ought to focus your attention and come to understand the story of Abraham as your father and of Sarah as the one who gave you birth. Abraham and Sarah are the model of the covenant. He's telling you if you want to be saved, first come to understand and respond to his covenant. Through them, Yahweh invited us to become his children, diminishing himself to bless us. That's one of the aspects of the preceding statement from Yahweh. He said he got on his knees to lift them up for our sake, making us infinitely greater than we are currently as mortal physical souls. But as such, and as much of the Torah and prophets confirm, before we can benefit from Yahweh's compassion, we must first change our thinking regarding the conspicuous signs that he has posted along the way to life. As a result of Paul's letters, as a result of rabbinic arguments in the Talmud, most Christians and Jews despise the Torah. They reject Yahweh's signposts along the way. And as a result, their attitude towards God precludes them from forming a relationship with him and being saved by him. Of course, then with Muhammad's Muslims, they were told that the Quran confirms the Torah when it in fact contradicts every aspect of it, precluding all Muslims from ever coming to know God or entering heaven. We are told that the beneficiaries of God's promises will witness the transformation of the earth. That which man has destroyed with his lifeless words, with his destructive institutions, with religion and politics and militaries and economic schemes, will be restored and reestablished by Yahweh himself as he transforms earth into Eden. He is, of course, speaking of the 1,000-year-long celebration of the called-out assembly meeting of shelters, where all of the damage we have done to ourselves and our planet is undone, enabling Yahweh to enjoy our company and us to enjoy his company, camping out with him for 1,000 years. It is between year 6,000 Yah and 7,000 Yah as you look at God's calendar. Year 6,000 Yah is 2033 on our pagan timepiece, and he's going to return on the Day of Reconciliations, which is October 2nd of 2033. 7 years prior to that, the tribulation begins, and all of the hell we discussed during the first hour of the program will be unleashed. As a result of what Yahweh has done for us, we, those of us who have been perfected and placed in this perfect place, and we would include everyone who has embraced the terms and conditions of his covenant. That's the means to salvation. God saves his children. He does not save everyone. He only saves his children. And that's as it should be. God's nature is such that he is opposed to those who oppress his children. His children are Torah observant. If you are opposed in any way to observing the Torah, then you are God's enemy, not his child. The covenant is presented in only one place. It has not been renewed. There are not two of them. There's only one. Therefore, there cannot be a New Testament. Yahusha did not speak of a New Testament. He did not create a new religion. Paul was a complete and utter fraud. As a result, there's only one path to God. It is the Moed Mikre, 7 steps long. Very few people celebrate it and observe it as Yahusha did, as it is presented in the Torah. But even that path is a byproduct of the covenant, of which there are 5 specific conditions that are established by Yahweh for our participation. It is his home. It is his family. He only wants those to participate in his home and to join his family who agree to these terms and conditions. They are his. They are not negotiable. They are not mine. There is no reason to get mad at me for telling you these things. They are his. Read his Torah. The first of those is that we walk away from our country, that we stop being political and religious. The country in specific that Yahweh asked Abram to walk away from was not just by chance Babylon. It was Babylon for a reason, because God goes to great lengths in his prophetic books, particularly in Yeshayah, the book that we are reading now, and also in Yirmiyah, Isaiah and Jeremiah, devoting his text, his words, to explaining why the religions and politics and the military and economic schemes of Babylon are so corruptive. And they are the very schemes we are seeing playing out in our world today. It's why Yahusha, in his revelation to Yahuchanan, asks us at the very end to walk away from Babylon because we are mired in it. God has asked us to walk away from religion and politics, to walk away from being patriotic. It's why we devote the first hour of the program to exposing the malfeasance of government. It's important that more and more people recognize that your government, your political party, your religious affiliation is not part of the solution. They are part of the problem. God wants you to disengage, to walk away from them. It's the first requirement of the covenant. There'll be no religion in his home, no politics in his home, no militaries in his home, no flag waving in his home, no bowing down and praying in his home, no worshiping in his home. Next, he asks us to, rather than trust and rely on our government, which so many people do today through the entitlement programs, depending, saying that they place their freedoms, their trust, and their freedoms come by way of their military sacrifice. God says, no, I want you to trust and rely on me instead. Now, you don't have to. You don't have to leave your country. You don't have to walk away from politics and religion or being patriotic or being militaristic. You don't need to do those things. You don't need to trust and rely on Yahweh. You only need to do those things if you want to be part of his family, enter his home, and live with him if you want to be saved. The third requirement, before I move on to the third, I should say that there is no way that anybody can come to trust and rely on Yahweh unless they first come to know him as he actually is, which can only be done by reading the Torah where he introduces himself to us. And they come to understand what he is offering, because you cannot rely on something or trust in something that you do not understand. And the only way to understand what he is offering is to read the source of instructions on that offering, which is the Torah. The third requirement is to walk to God to become perfect. There's only one path that Yahweh provides. That path is established historically. That path is established in words. That path is established with his own personal sacrifice. That path begins with a doorway named Pesach Passover, which is essential to survive our mortality. The threshold of unyeasted bread or matzah occurs on the next day where we are perfected. This enables Yahweh to adopt us into his family on firstborn child, Bukurim, where then we can be enriched and empowered on Shavua, the fourth step along that way. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the commercial break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. You can participate in our conversation, 877-300-7645. We're considering the statement that Yahweh made in Yeshayahu. One of the beauties of the prophetic statements in Yeshayahu is that it's the one book that we have entirely complete from the Dead Sea Scrolls collection. The Great Isaiah Scroll, as it's called, his name is Yeshayahu, it means salvation is from Yah, is displayed in its entirety in what's called I think it's the Dome of the Scroll, but in Yisrael. It was found as part of the Dead Sea Scroll collection. And while most of the Dead Sea Scrolls are fragments of books and from some books like Devarim, which we've misnamed Deuteronomy, we have dozens and dozens of different copies and fragments of different copies. And while we have many copies of Yeshayahu, one of those copies dating to around 150 to 175 BCE is complete. So it's the one place that we can look for Masoretic or religious copy editing and to be relatively certain that we have an absolute minimal amount of it, because those who copied the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms, particularly back 2,200 years ago, were attempting to be extraordinarily meticulous in their copying. It's very different in the Hebrew Torah and prophets versus the Christian so-called New Testament. In Christian manuscripts, the copyists were extraordinarily liberal. They were always willing to edit the text. That is why, if you look at the 69 pre-Constantine manuscripts, they differ from one another wildly, but there's also 300,000 known differences between what they record and the popular or common texts that have been unified to create the Textus Receptus and then the Nestle-Aland after it. When you realize there's only 180,000 words in the so-called Christian New Testament, and there are more than 300,000 known discrepancies, you can see how different the text is from that which was actually revealed. And even with the original Greek, most of these books weren't written in Greek, and none of the conversations they record were stated in Greek. So it is already a translation of what was said and what was written. And as I say, there's an enormous disparity between the oldest texts and the basis of our translations today. So it isn't remotely accurate. With the Hebrew, the discrepancies between the oldest manuscripts and from the Dead Sea Scrolls to the Masoretic are modest by comparison. One word between 14 and 15 is what we witness. I did a survey of Yeshayahu, since we have the entire book and since it dates to almost 200 BCE with the Masoretic, and found that that on average one out of every 14 words is altered. Some of the words are the alterations fairly modest. At other places, the alterations are massive. And the most common alteration is the Dead Sea Scrolls properly convey Yahweh's name as it was written. In the Masoretic, they wrote Adonai above Yahweh's name, so that when you read an English translation, you'll read the Lord as opposed to Yahweh. The Lord happens to be Satan's title. So in this particular testimony, we know we can dig deep because of the fact that we have it on good authority. So as a result of what Yahweh has done for us, we have been perfected, and we've talked about that path that he has provided to his home, which culminates in the Moed Mikra, the meeting where we have been invited and welcomed into Yahweh's company to be called out of this world, to camp out with him on Sukkah. That's the culmination of our journey. It's the culmination of the existence of planet Earth, when for 1,000 years, from year 6,000 Yah to year 7,000 Yah, we get to live with God in the conditions that were originally established in Eden. In the context of us changing our thinking regarding Sion, the signs that Yahweh has provided along his way to the restoration of life, it is especially instructive to reaffirm that Eden is not just the Hebrew word for great joy. It is derived from Ed, which means to provide an eternal witness and restoring testimony. It is an extraordinarily important part of that term, because what God is saying with Eden is that his eternal witness and his restoring testimony, which would be his Torah and his prophets, provide great joy. You can end your day today in Eden by examining Yahweh's eternal testimony and his restoring witness, which you'll find in his Torah, his prophets, and his Psalms. There is a great and multiplicitous result derived from Yahweh's covenant with Abraham. Yahusha is Abraham's merciful father seed. His redemptive sacrifice has restored thousands of souls, all of whom have been reborn spiritually. That is the reason the text recorded in the Dead Sea Scrolls had, "I multiplied him and I made him productive, as opposed to the Masoretic version of this passage, which says, I blessed him and made him productive. Along these lines, Yosef, corrupted to become Joseph, means Yahweh adds and increases, that he multiplies. It's the perfect moniker for someone cast in the metaphorical role of Yahweh as our Savior. It is also instructive to know that Edon and Eden are differentiated in the Hebrew solely by the initial letter, which is considered by scholars to be silent, although it isn't, it's a vowel. Edon, meaning the foundation of the tabernacle, the upright pillar, and the golden legs of the Messiah himself, Masayah, in the Song of Solomon, begins with an Aleph, which speaks of Yahweh having the power and authority, the capability of doing whatever is necessary. The Aleph was depicted by way of a ram's head, a lamb, in other words, a male lamb. While Eden begins with the Ain. The Ain is shown as an eye, as the iris and the pupil of the eye, for the purpose of saying this is speaks of us being observant, of us using our eyes to closely examine the evidence that God has made available to us. Eventually, they become one. Edon, consisting of the foundation of the New Jerusalem, the source of teaching on reconciliation, and the eternal tabernacle of Yahweh, and Eden, the place and time of joyous, satisfied living, are all unified into a single concept. That is the symbolic message here. Now, this occurs in stages. Yahweh will allow men to virtually destroy the planet and most of life on it, as he wipes out all wickedness and evil. The fact is that in three of Yahweh's prophetic statements, we find references to a nuclear holocaust, of the elements themselves melting with great heat, of the nuclear winter that follows a nuclear holocaust, of a third of the planet's surface being uninhabitable. And so man, who has devoted himself to conceiving destructive and deadly weapons, will deploy them. And that is why the earth needs to be restored. That is why, if Yahweh did not return, there would be no purpose of free will. There'd be no purpose of life, because all life would be extinguished on this planet. That's how hellish man is and will continue to be over these next 20 years. Reconstituting the earth into the Garden of Eden conditions is his promise. It's a paradise where Yahweh will rule for 1,000 years during mankind's final celebration of the Shabbat. Then the heavens and earth will be destroyed and replaced by a new creation devoid of deceit and desolation. That new heaven and new earth is required and is spoken of consistently throughout Yah's prophetic timeline. It is also what God is trying to convey with the eighth day, eight being the symbol for infinity, of Sukkah, where we celebrate not only camping out with God, but on the eighth day, we celebrate a new beginning, a new eternity. Now, the reason that God has to create a new universe at the end of our 1,000-year celebration of living in the Garden of Eden here on earth is that we are going to be empowered such that we become more like God. We will be, as was Yahusha, following his firstborn child, Bukhuram, state, where he was released. His soul was released from Sheol, reunified with Yahweh's spirit, and he became an entirely different kind of individual relating to this interaction between energy and physical matter, being able to transform himself between the two when it served his interests. And as we will spend most of our time as energy-based entities, our soul being energized and empowered by God, we will be able to explore time itself, where we cannot now. We're stuck in time. But imagine in eternity where God said there will be no more sorrow. Imagine being able to go back and look at your own mistakes. That would bring sorrow, wouldn't it? Look at the times that if we had acted differently, perhaps other members of our family and loved ones might have come to become more receptive to Yah's covenant teaching. That would bring us sorrow. If we looked at the man's inhumanity to humankind and we investigated what we did prior to the flood that splashed up into Mesopotamia, it would bring us sadness. If we looked at the news today, it would bring us great sadness. So what Yahweh has created is a means that we can be witnesses to a new universe, a new universe to explore, where we're witnesses to its creation, where we can travel back in time, forward in time, where we can travel to its furthest outskirts and yet never be ever burdened by the faults that have permeated our lives up to this point. They are all forgotten. God's going to view us as perfect, as righteous, just as he does Dod, David. And so we'll be able to exercise all of the freedom that energy provides without the resulting liabilities as a result of him mercifully creating a new universe for us to explore together. I'm Yada. We'll be back with Shattering This after the commercial break. It's an amazing statement that Yahweh has told us what the earth will become. And it's what's so amazing about this is that most people don't pay it any attention. They really don't know what awaits us. And you can read the newspapers and know that the world's about ready to break out in World War III. Yeah, that's pretty obvious. You can read the newspapers and see that Islam is incredibly destructive and it is behind 99% of terrorist acts around the world. You can look at the newspaper and see the hellish conditions that Islam perpetrates on its own devotees in the countries that it is so destructive. You can read the newspaper and see that man is destroying himself through financial malfeasance. I mean, it's obvious that we're coming to a crashing halt. It's obvious that politicians have become so corrupt that there is now no hiding the fact that they are actually working against their citizens as opposed to for them. And that the kind of reckless murders that are being perpetrated in the name of government are going to lead to a nuclear holocaust. We know all of that. It's obvious. But God has said that not only is he the remedy, that he's going to be the one who stops it, which means we can put our trust in him. But he says, I'm not just going to stop the hellish acts. I'm going to restore the earth to exactly the conditions that I originally conceived. And even her lifeless places will be as Eden, and her desert wastelands will be as a garden enclosure of Yahweh. Overwhelming happiness and joy will be found in her songs and the sound of singing, with the accompaniment of musical instruments. Sorrow and mourning for the dead shall disappear. While there is joy in the midst of sorrow, and joy is more than the absence of sorrow, perfect joy requires an abolition of sorrow. This is the reason that Yah must abolish the existing universe, as we were talking in our last segment, at the end of the millennial Shabbat, and will replace it with a new one. So after God demonstrating what the conditions of Eden were designed to conceive for 1,000 years, demonstrating that it's possible to a large group of people that, yes, we can live in harmony, not only with one another, but with our God, and that we don't need to be destructive, and that we can do things that are so much better than building weapons and designing schemes to kill one another, to rob one another, to deceive one another. He's going to demonstrate that the original plan that he conceived for the covenant in the garden prevails. And after doing so, and us having the joy of living together for 1,000 years on the earth as it was intended, then he's going to create this new universe, replacing the old one. In our current realm, our curiosity might cause us to explore our past and thereby enable us to witness many of man's worst deeds, a sorrowful experience to be sure. But in a new universe, one without painful past experiences, there would be no limits to our curiosity and to our exploration. Now, it sounds like a wonderful place. Unfortunately, we have a confirmed reservation now. That is, those of us who have read the Torah come to know its God, its author, the author of life, and have come to embrace and accept his way, his signposts, his moed mikre, his covenant. So while I can't prove it, knowing Yahweh, I expect that our eternity is going to be exciting, a time of great adventure, of discovery, of entertainment and joy. I think that he tipped his hand as to what eternity is going to be like in the story that he told us about his relationship with Adam in the garden. It is a time, therefore, of great adventure. And I think that his words seem to confirm that we will be able to see and experience vastly more than we can now. When we are elevated from three dimensions to a minimum of four and perhaps to as many as seven, I think Yahweh is going to provide us with the ability to discover and to discern things which can't even be imagined where we sit today, even if they were explained to us. Now, returning to the first Eden, to the joyous enclosure, and now that we know that it was not only a real place, but also a metaphor for the place that we are going. After reprising the beginning of the passage, we discover, and Yahweh Almighty planted and firmly embedded a sheltered and protective garden enclosure, conducive to life in Eden, from the east, and he established him relationally, fashioning and forming the man named Adam there. That's Bar-Reshith in the beginning, 2:8. So as we commence this discussion in our program tomorrow, we're going to consider the man that named Adam, that Yahweh established in his garden that was conducive to life and relationship in his Torah.